Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
We are!
We are!
The 99%!
The 99%!
And we are!
And we are!
On the Upper East Side!
Yeah, baby!
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Occupy Wall Street protests reported now in 150 cities nationwide. There yesterday, marching to the ritzy doorsteps of Manhattan moguls. The protesters say our economy and political system and more have gone off the rails, corrupted. They're angry that the top 1% has so much wealth. They say they speak for the rest, the 99%. This hour on Point, the Occupy Wall Street movement with us in the studio and from around the country. It hasn't even been a month, but there's attention all over the world now to what's going on across the USA, some friendly, some not. In a speech to the Values Voter Summit in Washington on Friday, House Majority Leader Republican Eric Cantor had harsh words for the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations spreading around the country.
If you read the newspapers today, I, for one, am increasingly concerned about the growing mobs occupying Wall Street and the other cities across the country. And believe it or not, some in this town have actually condoned the pitting of Americans against Americans.
Growing mobs. And Eric Cantor talking about Americans against Americans on Sunday. House Minority Leader, Democrat Nancy Pelosi, told Christiane Amanpour on ABC's This Week that Cantor didn't object when the protesters in the streets were Tea Party conservatives.
I didn't hear him say anything when the Tea Party was out demonstrating, actually spitting on members of Congress right here in the Capitol, and he and his colleagues were putting signs in the windows encouraging them. But let's not get down to
that. But do you think it's pitting Americans against Americans?
Well, it's the American system. It's the democratic system. We don't all agree.
And the President of the United States had a news conference at the White House last Thursday, throwing his arms rhetorically around the movement, said he'd seen some of the protests against Wall Street on television and thought the movement was an expression of frustration across the country.
I think people are frustrated, and you know, the protesters are giving voice to a more broad-based frustration about how our financial system works.
Let's go straight to that voice. With me now in the studio is John Phoenix. He's a student at Northeastern University who has been in the thick of the Occupy Boston protests, which saw 141 arrests earlier this week. John Phoenix, welcome. Great to have you right here with us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to meet you.
With us from New York is Bree Lembitz. She's been sleeping in Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan for nearly 3 weeks now as part of the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations. She's from Colorado. Bree Lembitz, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And finally, from Los Angeles, we're joined by Peter Coons, a veteran community organizer with the Alliance for Californians for Community Empowerment, who's been participating in the Occupy Los Angeles demonstrations. Peter Coons, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Bree, let me come first to you. 3 weeks in the sleeping bag in Zuccotti Park. That's not easy. That takes some dedication. No tents, just out there. Why are you there, Bree?
I first heard about the movement through Democracy Now, and then I was paying attention to it in the mainstream media, and they were talking about the numbers dwindling. So I was not sure if I wanted to join in the movement. Then after the macing, which happened now almost 3 weeks ago.
This is the pepper spray of a number of people that were corralled by New York police.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I just started watching the live stream, which is on globalrevolution.com or on OccupyWallStreet.org. Or .net, and decided that I needed to be a part of that movement and that energy. And so I dropped what I was doing, came to the park, and have been there organizing ever since.
There's a movement, energy. John Phoenix, why are you there?
Well, I can tell you my own perspective. It might be a little bit different from everybody else's. You know, the bigger picture is, you know, society is too damn unfair. I guess my own perspective could be various combinations of the phrase, tuition is too damn high.
You College know, tuition.
Yes, I'm here, you know, my...
Well, you're 21, 22, 3?
I turned 23 on Monday.
Congratulations, happy birthday.
Thank
you're what year in college?
Senior.
And you're feeling the weight of that tuition, what it costs to be there.
Yeah, and, you know, it is a sad fact that, you know, you have a lot of colleges who have spent more and more of their resources focusing more on image, college rankings, less on less at education. The cost of college has gone up at 4.5 times the rate of inflation. And meanwhile, on top of that, you know, you have a quarter of our age cohort unemployed. And according to Rutgers University, you know, half of college graduates aren't even able to find a job in their field. And it's sad. It's depressing. And, you know, we see the wider unfairness of society mirrored in our universities. And I also just want to say to Peter and Bree, welcome, brothers and sisters. Keep up the great work across the country.
There you go. Occupy solidarity right there. Hold the thought, John Peter Coons. You're in Los Angeles. You're a decade or a little more older than Bree and John. You've got experience with community organizing. What's brought you out into the Occupy Los Angeles arena, Peter?
Well, you know, it's interesting to see what's happening around the country because people are fed up, as I think John just expressed one perspective of why things are not going well right now for many people. And, you know, this is a set of issues that are related to the economy that I've been working on for many years. But it's just great to see larger numbers of people taking the streets and taking action to push for change.
Bree, you said you were drawn by the energy and the movement itself. What critique are you putting out? I mean, you've worked with the sort of medical unit there and the media unit there, and you've got a kind of organization within the sometimes happy chaos there in Zuccotti Park. What's your bigger critique of the economy, the country? What's your gripe, Bree?
Well, I think that the gripes that John just voiced are symptoms of the greater problem, which is the fact that the system that has been created is no longer allows for a democratic process because you've created so much power with the money that you now have a dual constituency. So you have to, politicians have to listen to both investors and the financial sector as well as the greater population. And that sort of structure is one that marginalizes the voices that need to be heard because those are the voices that don't have the power of the money, and those are the voices that the government should be protecting. So I believe that we need to restructure the system, and if that means creating a new system from the bottom up, I'm willing to do that.
That's a tall order, a big, wide one. John Phoenix, you said you see unfairness in the economy in the country. Is there a bigger political critique that surrounds that?
Well, I'd first off have to say that, you know, as any sociologist would say, the politics and the economics are very, very integrated here. I mean, I think, you know, going off the system, one of the things that categorized a lot of the 1990s movements were, you know, a lot of single issue campaigns that sometimes came together, like, you know, the turtle teamster unions of the late 90s. Now I think you find a much growing set of consciousness saying that, you know, we have the overarching problems of capitalism, which sees politicians as a commodity that can be bought and paid for, people as commodities that can be bought and paid for, education and a whole host of other things the same way. So I think, you know, what needs to happen is to link together these different issues and notice that, you know, we do have the common enemy, which seems to be the economic system itself, which is, you know, on one hand, we have that critique now, we have that consciousness now that I don't think we necessarily had as much of in previous decades.
You're a member of the Northeastern chapter of the Students for a Democratic Society. Americans of a certain age will remember that from the 1960s. We're going to talk later in this hour with Todd Gitlin, who was national president of the SDS back in the day. Does that define or say something about where you want to take things? Bree says fix the system or change it outright from the bottom up. What's your goal?
Well, again, this is my own perspective here.
Yeah, and there are many. We know that.
It's not just a question of where do you want to go. I mean, in all honesty, finding the list of demands, that's the easy part, okay? Political changes, economic changes, social changes, you know, full employment, universal health care, public campaign financing, maybe workplace democracy. That's the easy part, coming up with a list of demands. The much harder part is figuring out, you know, how do we go from here to there? How do we basically build up the process? You know, going from basically, how do we implement, how do we go from these processes, these protests, these occupations, how do we go from that to policy change? That's sort of the big question. Like, the how is almost as important as the what.
Peter Kunz, you've been out there in this community work for a long time. What about that? How to get from here to there? Whatever they may be, and we'll talk about that. But do you see this as a lever to move standard electoral politics? Do you see it as a kind of, you know, cultural pressure to heighten awareness of certain issues? Where do you see this going? Where do you see the force of it, Peter?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of potential for what's happening right now to turn into a change in a variety of ways. But I think one basic fundamental fact that it seems like we're all touching on here is you're not able to make the changes that need to happen in society without changing the climate and public opinion. And right now, it seems like that's the first step that's being taken, is that, you know, there's too many people that are being left out of this current economy. And they're taking to the streets and they're, you know, expressing their concern about it. And so that's a precursor to changing, you know, the broader public opinion and setting the context for political change.
Bree,
so that's next.
Sorry, Peter. Bree, do you think you're doing that? Are you changing public opinion here, or representing, you know, just the numbers who are out there actually in Zuccotti Park, in the streets around the country?
I think that personally I felt like I was one in a million prior to this movement. I felt like I was the only person who wanted to really completely reevaluate the system. And that concept is one that has been articulated by many other people in the park that I've spoken to. And so I think that the movement, as much as it is changing public opinion, is also starting to voice a public opinion that had been there, but people believed didn't exist, believed that they were the only one that had that opinion.
And now we see others. Bree Lemons in New York, please stand by. John Phoenix with me here in Boston. Peter Kunz in Los Angeles. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Now is the time to move, or are you going to be subject to arrest?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Occupy Wall Street with three occupiers, protesters in New York, Boston, and Los Angeles. Sound behind me right there of police in Boston clearing protesters. A lot of arrests there just the other night. Demonstrations now springing up all around the country. Many, many cities and towns, maybe yours. We have got a lot of questions online, big thumbs up, and big questions as well for Occupy Wall Street and on the phone lines. Laura in Des Moines, Iowa is calling. Hi, Laura, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom, thanks.
Yeah.
Well, we're having our own Occupy DSM, Occupy Des Moines, mm-hmm. here in Iowa, also in Iowa City. And it's really exciting. I'm excited to take my daughter there later today. We seem to have this going on all over the country, and I think that Eric Cantor needs to recognize that these are not mobs. These are people. A lot of them are ex-Tea Partiers, maybe. They're libertarians, they're liberals, they're conservatives. And it's about the democratic process, and I think it's a great thing.
Laura, I appreciate your call. It's interesting. Eric Cantor is already, just in the day and a half since the growing mob comment, he's kind of backed off that. People are not sure where this is coming from, going to, and maybe don't want to be on the wrong side of it. Brian in Savannah, Georgia. Brian, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hey, Tom. How are you?
Well.
I wanted to lend my support, I believe, 100% in the movement and the power of having the people be upset and expressing that they're upset. But I think it should be made clear that to just be upset and in the streets and protesting will not get to the point. And I think that there needs to be a solidified idea of what we're actually against, which is essentially the system of capitalism and its inevitable effects on society. Which is a real big ball to try to bounce. And I just believe that power structure that they're really talking about, I mean, there are a lot of other issues they mentioned, college tuitions and the unfairness in that, but all of those things are engulfed in this system that we so love. And I'm with the protesters, but I'm a little hesitant because I realized the gravity of the situation that we're dealing with.
Brian, let me ask you, if you don't want capitalism, what would you like personally in its stead?
Well, that's a hard question because it's essentially there's no such. I don't believe that there's no one capitalism or socialism or communism. There are good in all of those systems. There needs to be a melting of the different ideas within all of those systems.
Yep, Brian. Let me hold it right there and get one more. We'll take it to our Occupy Wall Street protesters, Phil in Omaha, Nebraska. Phil, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It seems like we're in this place here in our political world of extremes. We have the Tea Party that's going to their extreme, and this seems to be going to its own extreme. And I'm wondering if I could see a movement where people demand compromise, demand action, demand more legislation to be passed, instead of the polarization in the protests to the far left and the far right, just like in politics in Washington, when you see, I mean, it doesn't help to have people fighting on the far left and fighting on the far right. I think there needs to be a movement right there in the middle.
Phil, we've got it. Let me take it to our panel. John Phoenix, first to you. You hear Brian saying, look, I'm open for something else. The system's got problems, but some mix of things, I'm not sure what.
Right.
Laura in Des Moines saying, here we go. And then Phil, you want some compromise, some legislation here. So what is it? Revolution? Legislation?
Well, I'm going to put it to you this way. You know, the political left has a huge number of advantages right now that we did not have in the 20th century. You know, early 1990s, one economist in South Carolina and another economist in Scotland, Alan Cottrell and Paul Cockshott, they write a book called Towards a New Socialism, saying, okay, if we want socialism, here's how it would work, here are the policies that would need to be implemented. When they had the Russian Revolution in 1917, they didn't have a clue how to implement what they wanted to do. Now, because we've had the experience with Stalinism, Maoism, and all those other isms in the 20th century, we've understood participatory democracy is not a nice little add-on, but rather it is fundamental and crucial to the process of what we're trying to get. So on the one hand, you know, in terms of possible policy solutions, we have a lot more out there. But, you know, I wanted to go...
Is socialism what you personally want in full or not?
Yeah.
And do you think this country culturally can come to that? Is it ready because of all the buffeting and unemployment that it's seen? Or, you know...
Let me put it to you this way. Mm-hmm. What worries me is the fact that we might be going into a Japan-style generation of stagnation. Now, in Japan, you know, they haven't exactly gotten out of that recession yet. And here in this country, you know, we have the whole idea of the American dream, which, you know, I think on some level people are starting to realize maybe comedian George Carlin was right. Maybe it's a dream you have to be asleep in order to believe. So, you know, maybe a different economic system or different economic path would, you know, give people more of a chance to live up to their fullest potential. But I wanted to go to something, you know, Phil said.
In Omaha, okay?
Yeah, Phil in Omaha. I can understand where the desire for compromise comes from.
Don't polarize us more, please. Let's get together and fix things and legislate compromise.
The problem is that there are always going to be divides in politics. You know, I think that the idea, you know, let's all get together, work for the common good. Well, that's great up to a point, but what happens when different groups have different ideas of what the common good is? And, you know, October 1973... Business Week magazine runs an article saying, and I quote, it will be a hard pill to swallow for the American people that they can have less so that business can have more. You know, I think Warren Buffett had a point too. You know, he said this already is a class war. It's been declared for generations, and my class, the upper class, has been winning.
Peter Kunz in Los Angeles, compromise in legislation or revolution? How do you see what's brewing in this movement?
Well, I'll tell you one thing, Tom, is that right now it's, you know, you can talk about people being out there being extremists, but what I see is a lot of people who have been disaffected and not engaged, and it's a positive thing that, you know, thousands of people across the country are actually engaging in the, you know, the policy debates right now and expressing themselves.
You know, actually, I didn't characterize anybody as an extremist. I'm just listening and reflecting.
Oh,
and my question is the same to you. I see the engagement, and, you know, we'll see how far that goes.
Right.
But, you know, you've worked on this for a long time, Peter. I'm sure you've lobbied for legislation. I know you've worked a lot about housing issues. You know, so what is it? Is it to fill in Omaha? Is it compromise and legislation? Is it something else, something more revolutionary than that? What are you pushing for?
Well, I was just to clarify, I was responding to Phil's comment about the two extremes, you know, being out there. But yeah, in general, I think that, you know, regardless of how you feel about capitalism or other economic systems, what we're seeing right now is capitalism out of control, clearly. And my organization and others, you know, we're part of a coalition called Refund California that have been advocating for some time for a set of policies that are real bread and butter issues like the ones that John raised at the beginning, that a college education is becoming more and more unaffordable for regular working people, that it's becoming harder and harder to achieve or to keep the American dream of homeownership. And there's a set of simple policy issues that banks, particularly Wall Street banks, could be implementing that, you know, create the funding for a decent public education for the first time, you know, in history. California last month, the University of California started receiving more money in tuition than it did from the state. And so it's becoming a system where, you know, if you have the means to go to college, basically from the beginning, then that's that determines your chances of getting a college education. So fair taxation, taxing at a fair rate those that have the most, which include large corporations and the wealthiest 1%, and stopping foreclosures in a real common sense way. There's a number of policies that can be implemented, and we've been organizing homeowners in a way that's connected with the Occupy Los Angeles movement that has actually helped raise those issues and put a personal face on who's really out there making these points. It's, you know, it's regular working class homeowners in addition to students, in addition to a number of people that have been affected
making the points,
negatively by the economy.
Yeah, making the points and hurting. Bree Limbitz, there's some very practical responses from Peter Kunz. You know, how do you see it? Policy changes or, back to your word, Bree, revolution?
Or both.
I mean, I may be more radical.
I mean,
than
revolution
many
does change policy, that's for sure. But.
Exactly. I wanted to respond to the concept of polarization and speak to the fact that when you have a majority win system, you set up a system in which you have two poles because you either win or you don't, and it's a yes or no. And the direct democratic process that has been employed in many of the GAs that are in the assembly or that are in the occupations across
GAs,
the country.
These are general assemblies, kind of democracy in the streets
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. That are in the occupations across the world. And actually, there's over 1,017 occupations across the world now.
Okay.
But those kind of that kind of direct democracy system does not see the polarization of two sides. So it's not a compromise between two sides. It's a compromise between a broad spectrum of issues. And I think that that is something that has been missing from the structure of our democratic process. Speaking to capitalism, I believe that capitalism, the laissez-faire capitalism and the neoliberal implementation that currently exists is the issue with capitalism. So I completely agree with it's capitalism gone awry. But I think that there is a way to implement a democratic capitalism. And you see this through implementing solutions like employee stock ownership options, workers' cooperatives that allow each worker to have a vote in the policies of the broader corporation. And it may be that you can't have a multi-million person corporation because you simply cannot address all the voices within that corporation. So you must have smaller corporations that work up toward that multi-million person corporation. But these kind of options have been implemented.
And it's kind of empowerment, again, to your phrase, from the ground up. Let's hear from our listeners. Tim in Boston. Tim, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how's it going? I'd like to preface this with when I was younger, I was actually arrested and detained in a anti-government rally thing when I was 17.
Okay.
Later on, I grew up a little. I ended up doing 6 years in the military. And right now, I'm the same age as John and Bree. I'm having a lot of problems with the money situation and everything like that. But I really don't think that they really speak for me and a lot of guys in my situation. Personally, the way I'm dealing with this right now, I'm part of a political campaign and doing some direct action with that. I feel I'm making more of a difference trying to get a politician in office that's going to help out, as opposed to just standing in the streets yelling at people with bullhorns.
John, what do you say to Tim?
Well, first off, hi, Tim. What's up?
How's it going, John?
Going good. I understand what you're coming from in terms of politician. I mean, I'm working with a political campaign, too, and I do actually believe you bring up a very good point. You know, this is the easy part right now. I don't think a lot of people realize that. You know, whenever these protests start, there's always that initial euphoria. You know, what happens 3 months from now when the initial euphoria is faded, when the initial press coverage is faded, when it's 10 degrees below freezing, and, you know, you have... you know, perhaps people, not as many people coming out to the protests as possible. And I think you really underscore a very important point that these protests have to at some point be translated into a tangible organization that can end up, you know, basically outlasting and building something up for the long term. You know, to the well-organized goes the victory, to the victor goes the spoils. You know, I don't think we want to see here what happened in Italy when they had 3 million people in the streets in 2003, and then all that energy dissipated because they weren't organized.
Let me ask you about a potential, and Tim, thanks for your call, about a potential first point of organization or early one. It's right in front of us, the 2012 elections.
Right.
So, you know,
Bingo.
There are Democrats out there who would love to have Occupy Wall Street kind of in their corner, that energy. There are others who are nervous about it. What about you? Are you prepared to line up for Barack Obama's re-election and swing this behind him or not?
No. Here's why. Have you ever heard of a guy named Alan Lichtman?
Yes.
Alan Lichtman, for those of you in the listening audience who haven't heard, Alan Lichtman wrote a really great book in the 80s called Keys to the White House, basically predicting who can win the popular vote of presidential elections. Obama is looking a lot like George Bush the first before Ross Perot entered the race. He could squeak by a victory on the basis of his one foreign policy success, lackluster, you know, domestic record. You know, I'd say the best
thing... Would you rather have Rick Perry, Mitt Romney?
I'd say this. I'd say, you know, you have to think long term. How do you translate protests into policy changes? The best thing, in my own opinion,
yep.
that could happen here is if these protests translated into a third party, a workers' party, that could turn, first off, the 2012 election to a real tizzy, get at least 5% in 2012 to get federal campaign funding, and then go into 2016... with a very, very good shot of winning. And, you know, this has happened before. In Canada, the New Democrats, Tommy Douglas, that's how they got universal health care in Canada.
Stephanie in Providence, Rhode Island, you're on the air. What do you think, Stephanie?
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm just calling because I'm 26. I've been working full-time for the last 10 years. I work full-time now. I go to school full-time. I'm putting myself through school. And I'm just wondering, where would all of the people who are, like, the force behind the Occupy movement, where would they be without their parents? How many of them are still living off their parents? How many of them whose parents put them through college? How many of them moved home because they could? What would your alternative be if your parents weren't there, you know, picking up?
Stephanie, let me ask you, you know, you're kind of challenging, you know, get real. But in your working life, do you see the issues that they're talking about? Are you sympathetic to the issues? Maybe you wonder why don't they have a job? But what about the issues they're talking about?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I definitely understand that. I do think we need social change, absolutely. But at the same time, I think there needs to be less of a sense of entitlement. I think, you know, I have a lot of friends that graduated college and want to go straight to Washington for jobs. And, you know, you have to work in coffee shops. You have to be waiters. You have to start at the bottom and work your way up. I don't think you can just, like, be mad that you can't find a job.
Stephanie, we got it. Bree Lembitz in New York, what about it? Sense of entitlement in the streets there? You know, maybe it's just, this is kind of like what Herman Cain said, get a job.
I mean, I've definitely heard that over and over, and the amount of hours that I put into organizing and trying to work on, as John has articulated, the long-term solution is more time than I ever spend in any job. But I also agree that yes, you do need to have the coffee shop jobs, but the issue that's missing right now is we have a decreasing middle class, which means you have the coffee shop job and you have the job in Washington, but there's a disconnect between those two jobs. There's no way to, like, slowly move up. And that kind of a system is impossible to ask for change through.
Pain and impatience being expressed there in the streets. We've got all kinds of response today. We've got Occupy Wall Street participants. Todd Gitlin with us when we return. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Occupy Wall Street with three occupiers, protesters from New York, Boston, and the sound right there behind us from Los Angeles, taped from just the last couple of days there. A little historical perspective right here with us from New York is Todd Gitlin. He's now a professor in the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, author of The Whole World is Watching and The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage. Back in the 60s, he was president for a year or two of Students for Democratic Society, SDS. Todd Gitlin, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi there, Tom.
What do you see in this movement in the streets of your city and now many beyond?
What I see is a movement, and movements are ragged. They're polymorphous, as Walt Whitman said about himself. They are large. They contain multitudes. There are more reformist people. There are more utopian people. There are people who disagree about particular demands. But what I see is a convergence, an overlap. It was very clear. I was on the march October 5th, the one that was joined by many unions, adding up to 10 to 15,000 people to fill Foley Square. And by far the two most popular and most animated chants were, number one, we are the 99%.
Yep.
And second, banks got bailed out, we got sold out. Now, so anybody who says they don't really understand what this thing stands for, I think is just not paying attention. Now, it faces lots of problems, and it's created a new element. And you know, everybody who was involved in the occupation deserves multiple congratulations for actually creating some new fact. Because many people have been grumbling and double grumbling for months about how the economy is still unwinding, that people are miserable, dispossessed, foreclosed, et cetera, all that, and nothing was going on. We know the political system is deeply corrupted. It's not just broken. It's deeply corrupted. How to transform it is a very difficult question that people ought to, I think, debate more in a more concentrated way. For example, I very much sympathize with a great deal that John Phoenix said. I think it was he who said that this was the easy part, which is true. However, the third-party option doesn't work in a presidential system. Canada, like other countries where there are significant third or fourth parties.
Not even to create pressure, or what about pressure or leverage? What about working at that level?
My point is in two words, Ralph Nader. Please don't pull us through that again. And so, please don't elect Mitt Romney president of the United States.
So, Todd, you've been around this track. It's been some years now. You know, what's your advice for how this, in your view, might most likely be impactful, effective in the long run?
I think that by acting as a leverage on the Democratic Party, which is not a party that I feel warmly about, but it is the only party which doesn't wholly belong to the plutocracy, by exercising, you know, a gravitational force there, it will remind intelligent Democrats that in many ways they point the direction to victories for themselves. Now, that doesn't mean that the movement should fold into any campaigns, but the emergence of a figure like Elizabeth, your candidate,
Elizabeth Warren, you're running for the Senate,
exactly. I think she might point the way to a new direction for Democrats. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is, you know, sort of the ideal candidate.
Todd, stand by. John Phoenix is full of energy to respond right here. What about it, John? Todd Gitlin, you know, voice of SDS in the past, says exercise leverage on the Democratic Party. That's the way to go. What do you say?
I like to quote Malcolm X. You stab a person 6 inches, you pull it out 3 inches. That's not progress. That's a man stabbed 3 inches. You know, and you know what these tent cities are? They're Obamavilles. They're the modern-day equivalent of the Hoovervilles of the 30s. And in case you and the listening audience haven't heard that before, you can tell all your friends you heard it here first. You know, all the stuff that gives the Democratic Party its so-called progressive veneer, Social Security, labor rights in the 30s, the only reason FDR passed any of that was because he was horrified of Huey Long running against him, either within the Democrats or as a third party, and potentially winning. Not to mention, you had a massive amount of labor organizing in the 30s that was organized mostly by the Socialist and Communist parties. And, you know, again, third parties have succeeded in the U.S. Best example? the GOP. They started out as a third party. And, you know, it usually takes about between 6 and 8 years for a third party to show potential. You know, the Republicans first ran in 1856, did mildly okay, ran in 1860 and won. The populists ran in 1892, got 8.5% of the vote. Had they run as an independent in 1896 instead of basically being co-opted by the Democrats, you know, we could have had an independent third party. The question is, why should we take all this energy and channel it into a force that already promised us so much in 2008 and has let us down?
Todd Gitlin, what do you say? I've just got you for another minute here. We've got so many people calling in, but your parting advice to John and Bree and Peter.
The only example in American history when a third party became a second or first party. Number two, he avoided my point about Ralph Nader. Number three, I'm not proposing for a minute that all the energy now pour into Democratic Party campaigns. That's a straw man.
Okay.
I'm proposing that there be a recognition on the part of both the camping people and the Democrats that this is a big movement with multiple strands, that they have value, that they should not be at war with each other, and that people will disagree for cultural and intellectual reasons about how to proceed, and that they are not, therefore, the enemy.
Keep an oar in the party politics of now. We'll look at that. Todd Gitlin, author of The Whole World is Watching, the 60s at Columbia. Thanks so much for being with us for a few minutes today, Todd.
Pleasure.
Karen in Columbia, South Carolina, you're on the air with our Occupy protesters.
Hi, thanks for talking to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the Tea Party first came on the scene, I'm a liberal, but I was actually excited because I thought, great, you know, they're going to form a third party,
yep,
and then Obama's going to get reelected. And I just wish that...
you mean by dividing the Republican vote? You thought they might divide the Republican vote or swing in behind?
Uh-huh. I think so. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think they would divide the Republican vote, and I think I was hoping it would be close enough that that would mean that it would be much easier for Obama to get reelected. And now, I don't know, it just sort of fills me with despair, the talk of the Occupy Wall Street forming a third party, because I guess I'm just a pragmatist, and I just don't want a Republican in the White House. And I think that the Tea Party has made a big impact on the Republican Party.
So, for the worst,
I guess, as far as I'm concerned.
But they've changed it from inside. Karen, let me take that to Bree Lembitz in New York. Bree, what if your work ends up unelecting Barack Obama? Does that concern you? Is it worth it to get a third party or a new movement going here? Or do you see that as the effect or not?
Well, I'd like to rearticulate what Todd said about the presidential system, which is that you create a polarity. So even getting a third party in to replace it as one of the major two parties, you're still creating a polarity that marginalizes voices that don't fit into one of those two categories. You have a black or white system, and we know humanity is not black and white. So I think that
are you worried that your work might unseat Barack Obama? Is that a problem to you, or that's just part of a process? It's fine with you.
I mean, I would worry about having a Republican in the White House, but I also think that there are those voices who are in Zuccotti Park with us now who would like to have a Republican in the White House. So linking this movement to any political party is detrimental to the movement right now.
Why would those voices like to have a Republican in the White House? I'm just curious, Bree.
I mean, there are those who, because it has been single-issue politics for so long, there are those who agree with certain single-issue hot-button topics that are linked with the Republican Party who would love to see somebody from the Republican Party in the White House. So from that perspective, you...
Because it would fire them up on their issues, you're saying.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you link it to the Democratic Party, you are then ostracizing and marginalizing those voices who join this movement because they feel like they can't be heard any other way. And creating a third party is still... playing into this polarization that is mathematically can be proved that that's the way that the presidential system works because you have a winner take all. So it's 50% or more gets the vote. So you don't have a broad spectrum of voices.
Peter Kunz, do you see the question of the 2012 elections uniting or possibly splitting, breaking this movement?
You know, I think that I think it remains to be seen a bit. I think that one big question is how are our elected leaders that are currently in office responding to what's happening on the streets? And, you know, again, I think that one of the things that's happened, at least I've seen in L.A., is that Occupy L.A. protesters are joining with all kinds of organizations and unions that have been working on these issues for years and raising, you know, a whole set of concrete issues that are really important economic issues for our country, like getting access to a college education, being able to become a homeowner, or stay a homeowner, being able to get a decent living wage job, which is obviously one of the core issues that people yep. are out there raising.
Yep.
So I think that these issues, you know, as things are moving forward with the Occupy movements around the country, these issues are being raised up. And we're looking to the elected leaders to find out how they're going to respond going into the 2012 elections. I think that folks out in the streets are fairly united around a set of core policy issues, putting aside for a second their party affiliation. But I do think that people are starting to ask the question of how can we translate this energy into electoral change if necessary, which it looks like it may be in some cases.
John, I want to put that to you. But first, Karen in Rochester, New York. Karen, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, thank you. Very interesting conversation. I particularly find that I agree with your guests there in the studio, the Occupy folks. I've had some differences of opinion with some of the callers today. One of the things I've been moved to call about is that I'm a 56-year-old woman. This is not just a movement of young people. I think mm-hmm. young people are taking the leadership. But as myself, someone who's been and very underemployed technical services person for yep. many years now. Yep. I feel that I've become too old to hire, and I'm certainly way too young to retire.
Mm-hmm.
I put a note out on the BBS here in Occupy Rochester looking for other people that might want to join me to go to Wall Street last Wednesday on the 5th, and two other middle-aged women joined me, and we got home at about 2 in the morning. It was a 5.5-hour drive each way.
Wow.
We found the experience to be probably the best thing we could have done rather than sit home and write yet another cover letter that doesn't get answered and send out another resume.
Karen, I really appreciate your sharing that. I mean, that's people, you and those who hopped in the car with you, speaking directly from their experience and taking it to the street. John Phoenix, our time ticks down. Think about what we're hearing in this hour from your fellow protesters, from our callers. What's it leave you thinking, John?
Well, first off, hi, Karen, and the best of luck starting up Occupy Rochester. And second off, you know, whenever you have a protest like this, or even a union going on strike, you always have, you know, some group of people who've maybe thought several steps ahead. You know, how can this lead to wider changes?
Mm-hmm.
The how question
mm-hmm.
answered. You have other people who, you know, only want a few minor economic demands and then everything else they want to compromise. The question is, can those who have thought several steps ahead, who, you know, can provide an alternative, not just, you know, what's the alternative to capitalism, but, you know, how do we get from here to there? Can those people who have provided that pull people in their direction? And, you know, again, I think one of the other issues that has to come up, and again, this being...
And you're sure it's going beyond capitalism, and you think that will sell in this country. You may be right, but there's a lot of history that says, you know, it keeps centering back on that, even when it's painful. The biggest... I mean, FDR got all kinds of protections in for people who were being run over and hurt badly.
True, but realize the New Deal did not end the Depression. If it hadn't been for World War II, he might have seen even more protests. But that's sort of, you know, mm-hmm. sort of the other thing I want to get at is whenever you have a movement, sooner or later, you are going to have disagreements over time. You know, you have in this tug of war we call politics, some people pulling towards wider change, the forces of conservatism, reformism, inertia, exhaustion, 20-degree weather in Boston pulling people in the opposite direction. So the question is, when you have these disagreements, how do you deal with these disagreements, not sweep them under the rug, and at the same time, not split into the Judean People's Front and the People's Front of Judea, like in the Monty Python
mm-hmm,
film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I think, you know, ultimately that comes down to some basic organizational questions. You know, can you have, I guess, a majority rule within a movement whereby, you know, we have an intense internal debate, we decide, you know, what's the best way forward, and those who might not necessarily agree with the majority, you know, can they at the same time go along with the majority and not split and form a new group? And can the majority be willing enough to revisit their decisions, you know, in case it turns out one path is a mistake and we have to go on a different path?
Do you feel in the street with you, John, that you've got some kind of general consensus about direction? Or is this the time for just raising the temperature on the, unsatisfactory conditions that are out there right now?
I'd say it's almost a little bit too early to tell. I mean, from what I've seen, you know, the nice thing about Boston is that what I've been saying about, you know, forming, you know, a better decision-making process, you know, whereby you can have the majority rule, you know, understanding that not necessarily everybody will agree. For my friend Casey, who's actually been running a few general assemblies in Occupy Boston, you know, that does seem to be the direction at least Occupy Boston's going in. You know, not just figuring out what we're against, but how do we go from here to there? And to respond to, I think Karen in South Carolina, Todd Gitlin, you know, about the third party not being feasible. Well, I'll put it to you this way. Sometimes you might just have to lose the battle to win the war, if you want to think about this strategically.
Bree, what happens when the snow falls, when the ice storm comes there in New York? What do you anticipate?
I have a below zero sleeping bag and tarp, so I'm going to try to stick it out.
Below zero sleeping bag and a tarp. And Peter Kunz, what do you think? Where are we going here?
Well, you know, I think that it's, again, it's an opportunity to continue to broaden the issues that are being put out there and add, some of the human faces to who's going through. I also haven't mentioned K-12 education is at historically low funding levels all across the country. So these are the set of issues that are being raised. And I think that the challenge is going to be going from where we're at now, raising these issues, to making real change in 2012 and beyond.
There is plenty to be unhappy about right now. We're seeing a lot of it expressed right there in Occupy Wall Street and right beyond. Peter Kunz in Los Angeles, thanks for being with us. Peter, Bree Lembitz in New York City, and John Phoenix with me here in the studio.
Thank you.
Thanks to each of you for being here. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
Listeners,
you.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.